And that's the kicking music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week on the show, we're going to talk about The Amazing Spider-Man. Is it good? Is it bad? Is it, well, necessary? I don't know. And how cute is Emma Stone anyway? In other news, in honor of our show's upcoming second birthday, we'll be celebrating the second annual Appreciation Day. In honor of that special occasion, we'll raise a glass to some of the things we've come to truly appreciate since last year at this time. And as always, we will talk about what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music, and later in this episode, I will be bearing a gift.
Wow. Uh-oh. Awesome. Not burying a gift.
Not burying a gift.
Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I am the movies editor at NPR.org.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Trey Graham.
Yes, ma'am.
You saw The Amazing Spider-Man.
I did see The Amazing Spider-Man.
Reactions.
I thought it was a little bit slow, but I find the two of them so completely charming together.
And we are talking here about...
The two of them, the leads, Emma Stone and Andrew Garfield.
Which one is Spider-Man?
That would be Emma Stone.
I didn't do the research. Emma Stone.
No. Andrew Garfield. Mm-hmm. Lately Tony nominated for his performance in Death of a Salesman on Broadway, mm-hmm. and here being just about as winning as any 20-something could be when done up in spandex and made to look dopey.
Yeah. I thought that, too. I think he's very good in it, and I think she's very good in it. Stephen, what were your thoughts?
I, first of all, felt the same way about both of those leads. I think they're both very charming. I think Andrew Garfield is you know, a very nice bit of post-Tobey Maguire casting. I think Emma Stone is particularly good post-Kirsten Dunst casting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If we're going to inevitably compare this mm-hmm. to the previous Sam Raimi Spider-Man series. The film itself has some inherent structural flaws, namely that it is retelling a story told very, very recently. I think there's a bit of dopiness here and there. I think there are a few moments in this movie that rang kind of false and silly. The banter as he's fighting bad guys, I thought, given that they could have looped in any lines they wanted, could have done way better. If dialogue can be clunky during a fight, I felt it was clunky during
yeah.
a
fight. But, you know, some of that is that character. No?
Sure, it's canonical. He's a wisecracking superhero who wisecracks while he fights. He's usually, he needed some punch up in this movie.
That was the part that I was shocked it wasn't more punched up.
Yeah, they needed the proverbial dentist from Long Island.
He's funnier in the comics.
Things.
He's funnier in the comics. I'm going to take issue with the fact that it was retold recently. Okay, this movie is an origin story. There have been origin stories told before. The origin stories are what superheroes are for. Mm-hmm. It's what they're about. It's the wish fulfillment part. I've said this many times. It's the hero's journey. Everything after the origin story is just two guys in suits wailing on each other. Mm-hmm. So the thing that is engaging is the origin story. So I have absolutely no problem with it being retold. In fact, that's what origin stories exist to do. They are updated often. Most of the time, they are treated like a good director treats Hamlet, where you take the bones of a story, mm-hmm. you seek out the things that you want to deal with, the mm-hmm. themes you want to pull out, and based on which themes you pull out and how hard you hit them, you create a different Hamlet. Am I comparing Spider-Man to Hamlet? Yes, I am.
Well,
tights,
and
emo, pushes away his girlfriend, and is also a wisecracker right there. So,
yep.
So there's your graduate thesis.
Well, and we've done that before. We've talked about how comic books are like soap operas in that you have to go back and reboot every now and again.
So I went into this thing saying, I don't care that it's the origin story retold. I'm up for this. And then I was bored. I was bored by the origin story.
Oh.
And it's because, and again, I want to say this is a taste thing. What I seek from these kind of movies as opposed to what other people do. I want to say that Garfield and Stone are great, effervescent, light shining out of their butts. They're great. The way the film dealt with...
Not literally.
The way the film dealt with his webbing was far superior to the Sam Raimi ones. It was really good. There's a crane sequence in here that really mm-hmm. works nicely.
Yep.
See, Thomas Howell, as Linda pointed out, was staying gold, as it were.
Uh-huh.
He was Pony Boy. Flash Thompson. They treated Flash Thompson great because in the comics, he does become a very good friend of Spider-Man. The thing that goes wrong with superhero films, for me, has nothing to do with the superhero component. It has to do with the summer blockbuster component, the screenwriting 101 canard that you need to make everything tie up in a very good way, that the hero must create the villain or that the villain must create mm-hmm. the hero and they must all come back together. That is overdetermined, really schematic, and it flattens the action and it kind of reduces the action in a way, and that's kind of what I felt was going on here.
I'm kind of with you, and I'm not sure if this is exactly what you were saying, but I really felt like this was one of the less interesting villains to come along, not just in any of the Spider-Man movies, but in really any of the big superhero movies that we've seen in the last decade or so. I have to say, I did like that the specter of Norman Osborn was hanging over this movie in this way. He's always in the background. And that was part of what put Lizardface, or whatever his name is, in the position to do what he did. But I wasn't particularly interested in the character himself.
Mm-hmm. I will say, you know, sort of to piggyback on what Glenn was saying, that in defense of the rebooting a recently, a story that a lot of people have seen told recently, it does have the effect, I felt like, of making the general audience geeks. Mm-hmm. General audiences who do not read the comic books can watch this and have sort of the same reaction that the hardcore people have with a lot of these stories. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody who reads Thor comic books is going to see the movie Thor differently than I, as somebody who did not read the Thor comic books, would see it. I did sort of get to see the film through the eyes of someone who can say, well, where's J. Jonah Jameson? You know, right. In ways that I ordinarily wouldn't get that opportunity. And I think as an exercise, that's interesting. But, you know, at the same time, I did find, and I enjoyed this movie. I don't mean to be like a big detractor from this movie. But, you know, I sort of felt, because I'd seen this story play out, there is a certain amount of, man, they haven't killed Uncle Ben yet.
I know, that's exactly what I meant by, I felt there's a fireworks factory and we were not getting to it. But, again, this comes down to a taste thing, because this is a different film than the Raimi films. The Raimi films, as Linda mentioned, played up the goofiness. I like the goofiness. That's what I read comics for. That's what I like superheroes about, is I like the fact that the lizard in the comics is a giant lizard in a lab coat. That's what I like about him. And when he rips off the lab coat, seconds, he just gives me that one glimpse of the lizard in the lab coat, and that's all we get. It just doesn't feel like... And when he, in fact, looks like a really buff Voldemort with eczema instead yes. of an actual lizard, you know, this is the thing. That's exactly what you're talking about. I wonder if other people felt that. Of course, they'd never seen a lizard before, so probably not. I will say that there's something interesting going on, and one of the reasons I didn't react as emotionally and joyfully to this film, it was a very intentional choice on director Mark Webb's part to do the thing which a superhero movie's about, which is the training montage, you know, the discovery of the powers with the inspirational power chords, that whole thing, and to subvert it a little bit. Because if you remember in the Raimi film, him discovering he has these powers, he's climbing up the wall and this look of elation on his face, and then he's soaring over the city. Because if you remember the first Raimi film, he was kind of poor. So he's right. getting up off the streets. Now, compared to that, in the Mark Webb film, Aunt May and Peter have moved on up to the east side, like George and Wheezy.
Yeah, it's kind of a nice house.
It's a really nice house in a really nice neighborhood. And if the thing that takes him out, when he discovers his powers, that all takes place in an abandoned warehouse where you don't see the sky. So it really works to contain the joy, contain the elation that I was looking for. But again, taste.
Okay, now Linda, you're a fan of this movie. You like this movie.
Yeah, I do.
Let's hear what you've got to say about it.
I feel like maybe I watched this kind of movie wrong or something. But
how dare you enjoy this movie?
Stuff like, what's the elation of the training montage? And, like, where's, like, is the lizard in a lab coat? Like, I feel like I don't care about that stuff. It matters so much more to me that the people in it be interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think I understand how much a lot of people love the Sam Raimi movies. Admittedly, I have seen the first one just recently, but it's been longer since I've seen the second one, which I know more people truly love. To me, the first Sam Raimi movie is fine, mm-hmm. fine. But for me, no better than fine. Just in the sense that I find the Tobey Maguire portrayal, as I've said to Glenn before, entirely too moist for my liking.
Yes.
Entirely too sort of...
Dewy-eyed.
Too sort of...
He does have a squeaky voice teen
sort
of thing.
It's not the goofiness. It's not like the be more man. It's not that. It's like there's just a certain kind of, like, to me, fundamentally uninteresting quality to that character, and especially to the Kirsten Dunst performance. Mm-hmm. That, to me, is just a nothing.
She's just a damsel in
distress.
It's
a nothing character.
Movie, yeah.
And to me, when you compare that to a film that had, for me, a bunch of really good scenes of humans, like people having conversations with each other that I thought were quite affecting. I mentioned when I wrote about this movie on the blog that the same conflict that takes place in the first Sam Raimi movie, it takes place between G. Willikers, Tobey Maguire, and Cliff Robertson sitting in the car, and Cliff Robertson's like, you know, you really got to be more responsible. And he's like, I got it. And he's like, why are you always picking on me? Well, you got to be more responsible. And then he goes off to school, and then he dies. Whereas in this movie, you have what I find this really wrenching, difficult conversation where they're trying to say, like, you need to be more responsible like your dad. And he comes back to, like, great, awesome. He wants to be this inspiration to me and everything. And that's, to me, is a really painful and effective scene. When you stack that on top of what I think are just these really marvelous scenes between him and Emma Stone. To me, any time that they are playing a scene together, there is this sort of lovely energy that is really extremely unusual. I don't care whether you're talking about, like, superhero movie or not.
Right.
To just see people playing off each other in that way. And his performance as a romantic lead is so unusual. That scene where they're on the balcony of her house and he's trying to sort of explain this to her, and there's kind of this constant sequence of, like, he's going to, and he thinks it's funny, and then he's going to, and it's terrifying, and then he's not going to. And none of it has words, because he's just kind of like, I love that scene. And to me, all this other stuff about, like, do I care about the lizard? Like, stuff is all to me.
Right. Well, what you're saying, I think, is that superhero movies, like any movie, are more interesting when you can believe in the characters, when you can connect to the characters in some way.
It's the thing I care about the most.
Yeah.
And it's one of the reasons why I am, in addition to the fact that the humor is lighter, it's another reason why I'm more of an Iron Man person than I am a Dark Knight person.
Right. Yeah,
there are no scenes in The Dark Knight between regular people that I have any memory of at all, basically.
And the closest you ever get, I think, is between Bruce Wayne and Alfred.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas you get, in Iron Man, you have this kind of cute relationship between him and Pepper Potts, but you also have sort of those early scenes between him and the guy in the cave when he's building the suit, and, you know, conversations between people where there seem to be stakes. So to me, I understand all this stuff about, like, it's an origin story, and it's, I don't like the training, I get all this stuff, but I don't care about any of it, because to me, it's so much more important that I care about the people, and I just love the lead performances in this movie so much. And I would take up for Reese Ifans.
Evans, I think. But
is it Evans?
Not positive.
At any rate, who plays the lizard. Glenn just made his poof noise with his mouth.
I did, because he's a poor man's David Warner. Puny. I'm sorry.
I want to say one.
Peter Parker.
He was made to do that. He didn't write the line, poor Peter Parker, for God's sake. You're also talking entirely about the lizard acting. I'm talking about
the lizard
also,
acting was not as effective.
I'm talking also about the, I mean, I don't think you can necessarily hold him totally responsible for the lizard acting.
No.
I'm talking about the human acting, you know, where he has the early exchanges with her and with Peter. Like, I think that's all fine. I don't think it's completely awesome, but I think it's fine, and I care about it more than I did all that stuff about James Franco and his freaking dad. I don't care that much. Like, to me, like, it worked because of the people, and I stand by that. I don't care what everybody thinks.
I've got to say, one place where I thought this script did a particularly good job was in the depiction of a moody teenager. Which is one of the things that I think what's his name in the earlier movies didn't do particularly well at. Tobey Maguire.
What's his name?
Yeah,
what's his name? Spider-Man.
You know, this one, Garfield, when you get around to the scenes with the adolescent douchery that he's displaying earlier on, you know, once he's strong and he's going to get his revenge on the bully by humiliating the bully in front of the entire room, he's going to indulge his anger with what really is, when you get down to it, vigilante justice, which is what people are accusing him of being, and he's claiming he's not, and he's smart-mouthing the cop about it, thinking he knows more about, as that scene indicates, he doesn't know more about what's the best way to go about fighting crime. Mm-hmm. He's a teenager. He is a teenager, and that stretch of the script really captures it.
He remains a teenager.
Yeah.
Right, and what the film does really well is capture the transition from vengeance to altruism, which is a big part of what makes a superhero a superhero. That was handled really well. I disagree about the schmoopy emo-ness of the teenage stuff, because that is something that I personally just feel very ambivalent about in this character of Spider-Man. I always feel he should be doing more punching and less whining. but I mean, that's just a taste thing. Linda, I don't think we're fundamentally disagreeing about this film. It's just a matter of what we value. And, I'm not going to say anything against Garfield or Stone. I thought they were great. They made the film better. I just needed a little bit more fun.
Well, okay. You say, I needed more fun. And I say, to me, fun in a movie like this is that scene between Emma Stone and Dennis Leary when she's standing at the door of her room talking about he's asking her if she wants cocoa.
Exactly. Right.
I think that's really funny.
Sure,
I think that's fun.
Linda, I didn't deny that it was your fun. I'm not saying there was no fun in this movie.
Well, you basically are subtracting J.K. Simmons as J. Jonah Jameson, who is just this ball of mania, you know, in the Sam Raimi Spider-Man. And you're sort of swapping in Dennis Leary, who is playing a more subdued character, who is not there doing antics. It's a quieter performance.
But it's great. It's really great. He's a lot of fun. Dennis Leary, he's great. I like
him. I like Dennis Leary in this movie. I think they gave him like the exact right number of great lines, which is like maybe five.
But it's also, for Dennis Leary in particular, who you tend to think of as a very broad character, he's hemmed in nicely in this movie.
They've fit him into exactly the right sort of character, where he's kind of decent but exasperated. He can do that, and he can do sort of the fundamentally good cop who is a little bit, I mean, I think what they've built into the DNA of this movie a little bit, no pun intended, is the idea that he is kind of responsible for the scenes that allow you to step back from the movie for a second in the way that the Sam Raimi movies do all the time.
Right.
Sort of step back from the movie and have Peter say to him, he's turned himself into a giant lizard. It's those scenes with Dennis Leary where it gives you that 5 feet of distance from the movie where you can say, like, yes, they understand that they are making a movie about a man who transforms himself into a giant lizard, and yes, that's a little bit funny.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Just once, when Andrew Garfield came back home to the long-suffering Sally Field, and she looked at him with those pools of pure compassion because she loves him unconditionally, even though she really shouldn't because he's kind of a douche, I wanted her to ask, what happened to you? And him to say, well, the first rule of Fight Club.
Well, you know, the other thing that I want to touch on before we get off this topic is, you know, a lot of the discussion of this movie has centered around the idea that Glenn brought up of the fact that, yes, there were Sam Raimi movies, and the last one was only 5 years ago, so how can they possibly do it again? And to the point where I've heard from a lot of people who essentially refused to engage the movie as a movie at all.
Right.
Including, and I'm going to pick on a critic I like a lot, Dana Stevens at Slate, who basically just sort of declined to review the movie and just kept writing about how, well, you know, it's fine, but of course it's unnecessary. It's fine, but of course they're lovely, but of course it's unnecessary. And I just got to the point where I was like, this is one of the reasons I didn't review Charlie Sheen's new show, is that I knew I didn't want to engage it as a piece of art. So if you're not going to do that, then don't do it. To me, writing a review of a movie that's all about the commercial imperative that the studio has in greenlighting it, I mean, what do you think was the studio's motive behind the Avengers?
Sure.
Art?
or the Sam Raimi Spider-Man.
Well, exactly. Nobody made the Sam Raimi Spider-Man because they were like, you know what this is? Needed.
Yeah.
Needed on an artistic basis by the world.
This. Everyone is clamoring.
I don't know. No one is clamoring.
It will feed our souls.
Well, and how many, as we've discussed in a fairly recent podcast, I mean, how many Draculas are there? How many Robin Hoods are there? How many, I mean, there are characters that get rebooted again and again and again and again. Spider-Man is a more frequently rebooted character than most. I mean, look at how many Supermans there have been.
Well, and people kind of go off into this whole, like, well, they made it because they have to make one every 5 years or the rights revert, and I get all that. But you know what? There's been a lot of conversation that's like, therefore, the movie is crass. Therefore, it's bad and I'm not seeing it. And to me, it's
like, and
there's
really no connection there.
The other thing is, all these movies are, you know, so many movies are dictated by who has what deal with who and who's trying to make money and who's trying to keep who under contract and all this stuff. It's just, this happens to be one where we know exactly what the business situation is. People know this particular detail, so they seize on it and say, therefore, this one is a cash grab. Unlike 21 Jump Street, which was necessary and therefore can get a good review because God knows everybody knew we needed more freaking 21 Jump
No. Yeah, and the reality is that, you know, cash grabs wouldn't work if there weren't an appetite for them. The studios could put up a reboot every 5 years or every 3 years if they wanted to. But if the audience wasn't ready to engage with the character again in the way that the audience is often ready to engage with Hamlet again, then it wouldn't have made $62 million domestically and another $128 million around the world.
That's in like 2 days.
Yeah.
This movie made way more than that.
It's over 150, I think.
Yeah, it was
now
opening.
I just feel like it's fun. It's fun. I enjoyed it. Go enjoy the movie. I don't know.
No, I refuse to enjoy it.
No, it's not fun.
You can't make
me
enjoy it.
I decree it's not fun.
I don't like
Airport's not fun.
Your fun is incorrect, Ms. Holmes.
My fun is not invalid.
I deny your fun. Poor Linda Holmes.
here's how you can tell. I saw this movie before it came out. I went to a press screening of this movie. And then we are taping this on Tuesday. And as it happens, last night on Monday, I went again with Glenn because I wanted to see it again. Haters, go ahead.
Haters to the left.
Go ahead, haters.
When I see this film again, I'll just have my finger on the fast forward button. That's all I mean. I'm still going to see it again. It's great.
Yeah,
parts of it, but there's some slow bits.
I love him. I love him. I'm going to adopt him and move him into my room, and I'm going to keep him in a little glass
pet
case.
Pet him and stroke him. And what's, how's that going?
He has great hair.
Call him George.
He has great hair. He's got the sculpted, you know, he's got that perfect wave of hair.
He's got a lot of hair.
Now I'm really losing focus.
Yeah, we need to bring this one home.
So I hope that all of you who have seen this movie will come and share your thoughts with us at our Facebook page, perhaps, facebook.com/PCHH, or at the blog at npr.org/PCHH. Speaking of our social media presences that we have here on the show, I'm going to turn it over to Stephen Thompson to talk about this weekend and what its significance might be for us. Stephen, why don't you explain to the people?
Well, as the calendar watchers among you are no doubt aware, I'm sure all of you, when you picked up your crisp new wall calendar at the end of December, I'm sure the first thing you did was write down that July 16th is the anniversary of our little program, Pop Culture Happy Hour.
Which anniversary?
It is our second anniversary. Oh. We have been doing this for an astonishing...
If you're thinking of sending us gifts, second anniversary is diamonds.
That's right.
Actually, corrugated cardboard.
Nubby plywood.
It's the nubby plywood anniversary. Little Nichols and May throwback there. Nice. And so, you know, last year when we came to the first anniversary of our little show, I got all ambitious and decided that we were going to start a new holiday because, you know, a podcast heard by hundreds.
I thought you were going to say that you got all nauseatingly sentimental.
I tend to do so. Mm. I am a nauseatingly sentimental sort of fellow. And so we came up with... I came up... Sorry. Glenn Weldon came up with Appreciation Day. I guess it's 12 days after July 4th, but I feel like there's a lull. that on July 16th, or, you know, this year I figured we'll do it Sunday, July 15th. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's the Sunday closest to...
Right.
To
observed.
Appreciation Day, parentheses, observed. Mm-hmm. And the idea behind Appreciation Day is that through social media, through free means of expression, no cards, no, nothing you pay for, you don't buy people anything, you use free social media to tell the people in your life the most positive thing that you can say about them. Not backhanded, not snitty, not sarcastic, a completely sincere expression.
It has to be nauseatingly
earnest. It has to be nauseatingly earnest, or God help me, I will find you. So
I love that Appreciation Day comes with a threat of violence.
So, and I'm a fairly imposing, terrifying kind of, you know, lest I hulk out of the cardigan I might be wearing on a given day. You know, Appreciation Day 1 last year, July 16th, was, I felt, a really lovely experience. We did the little hashtag Appreciation Day on Twitter. And I think all of us except Glenn participated last year. Mm-hmm. But what was incredibly gratifying about it was seeing on Twitter, kind of following that hashtag, and seeing complete strangers say incredibly nice things to other complete strangers. Mm-hmm. If you have an estranged relative, reach out.
Assuming your estranged relatives are all on Twitter.
Right.
Find your estranged relatives on Twitter. Anyway, the idea is that it is supposed to be a wave of love and kindness, the way that the show has been a wave of love and kindness for me.
That was unexpected.
Because that's what it's all.
All right. So the
about.
Short version of all this is, on Sunday, July 15th, take to Twitter. Hashtag is Appreciation Day. Write notes to all the people that you appreciate and tell them why you appreciate them.
Wow, that was so much more concise than me.
How about
you.
This? It's
From
an
me.
Exercise in passive-aggressive cyberbullying, which is trying to make me a better person, and I do not truck with it. I don't deny all y'all, you know, Mazel Tov, Pax Vobiscum.
Glenn does not celebrate Appreciation Day.
Go crazy with the Cheese Whiz, but...
Glenn does not celebrate Appreciation Day because he's not part of the Church of Kindness.
That's right.
Become Stephen Thompson, the home Hallmark cards of Twitter, and create a holiday and then reap the benefits, reap the adulation. Go ahead.
Ultimately, it is a giant pyramid scheme in which I soak up the most love.
Exactly.
That said, I do have an additional note.
Uh-oh.
So I wanted to do something a little special for Appreciation Day because I love you people so very much.
So you bought some lingerie.
I went to Victoria's Secret. No. Okay.
I'm never going to get that out of my head.
I'm sorry. Take a few quick steps back. For 6 years, I was coach and captain of the Onion's terrible softball team.
Right.
Along the way, experienced comical misadventures, learned some valuable lessons, lived, loved, learned. Mm-hmm. Wrote a 6,400-word essay.
It's no bachelor pad recap.
It's no bachelor pad recap, but it is very long. I think I like to think that the joke to sentence ratio in this essay is about 1-to-1. Mm-hmm. It's a piece of writing that I'm really happy with. Mm-hmm. And when I wrote it, sort of envisioned it as, possibly a chapter in a book. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I am on pace to complete this book long around the year 3850.
Right.
So basically, I am giving it to Pop Culture Happy Hour listeners as a downloadable PDF so that they may read it at their leisure and hopefully enjoy it.
And that's your gift to them for Appreciation Day.
I hope it is received as a gift.
And where will they be able to find it?
Well, I wanted a place, sort of a consistent place that people could find it where they could always download it. Mm-hmm. I set up a WordPress page for it at popculturehappyhour.wordpress.com.
Okay.
It will contain one blog post. That one blog post will contain the downloadable PDF for an essay titled "Here's to the Losers."
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. And in the honor of Appreciation Day, we thought we would go around the table and each name something that we have come to appreciate in the time since last Appreciation Day. So everything that you appreciated last year is disqualified.
Oh.
Everything we have ever appreciated before the past year.
Mm-hmm. I'm just kidding. But hopefully something that we have come to appreciate in the last year, since last Appreciation Day, since it has come around again. Trey Graham.
Noise. This has been...
you work in the right room.
Yeah, I know, right? All sound.
No, this has been a year of kind of getting back out into the world for me after a stretch when I had been hibernating more than not. Mm-hmm. I've always sort of thought of myself as a high-functioning introvert.
Sure.
And I like to spend a lot of time alone. Like I said, I've been getting out into the world a little bit more, and I've realized how much I do enjoy, in fact, a good carouse with friends. I mean, obviously, I'm 44, so it's not going to be every night, but a nice stretch of solitude with a book is something I value greatly. But, live concerts, for one thing, are something that I had really gotten out of the habit of doing, and recently I've been out to see everybody from Robin to Willie Nelson to the Scissor Sisters, after the last of which I spent most of the day not being able to hear anything and going, what is that strange ringing noise?
Next year you'll be talking about how much you've learned to appreciate earplugs.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. But yeah, being out in the world a little bit more is one thing that I am appreciating. And it would not behoove me to let this opportunity pass without saying, of course, the Pop Culture Happy Hour audience. I have had listeners stop me and say hi at NPR member stations, at parties, at the theater in New York, even at the DC sports bar where I play pub quiz. Hi, Derek. Hi, Melissa. I even got a Facebook message a while back from a person I did not know, a listener named Katie, who told me she'd been talking about the show to her mom, who recognized my name because she used to babysit me. So it is a small world, and it's really gratifying to me that people like what we do.
Wonderful. Thank you, Trey Graham. Glenn Weldon.
Last year at this time, I resented all these people who kept talking about Breaking Bad because, okay, we get it, it's a good show. And I had no interest in the show. I thought I knew what it was about. So I am not going to spend a lot of time on this because...
What does it say on my paper, Glenn Weldon, under Appreciation Day?
It says Breaking Bad.
That's okay, go ahead.
You got something else? No, go ahead.
I felt I knew what the show was about because I had heard too much about it. So I'm not going to spend much time here, but basically I've become one of those people who talks about how great the show is. In a strange way, it validates my worldview. It is a very comforting show for me, who is an incredible pessimist. It tells me that my view of the world is the right one. And so that's all I'm going to say about it. I did go back recently to watch the very first episode. And if you want to see how you can plant seeds, how you can kind of embed what a show is going to be about in the very first episode, it is an exercise in excellence. So Breaking Bad is my thing.
Wonderful. Right. Well, that really is what I was going to say. It says right on my paper, Breaking Bad. And like Glenn, and I have much less excuse than Glenn because I do write about television. But this is one of those that sort of started at a point when I wasn't quite following, all of television quite so closely. And over the years, when I had tried to get into it, I had gotten about as far as the first two or three episodes, which, as you know, if you've watched it, there's a lot of violence just to get into the swing of it. And I personally was a little turned off. I felt like, boy, this may be a little more heavy duty on the blood and guts than I personally can manage. So it took me a very long time. But after I realized, well, you know, it's on Netflix. I can watch it on streaming. I can sort of like see how it goes. I did push through kind of those first five or six, feeling a little bit like I wasn't yet sure that it was up my alley, but I wanted to continue to try. And ultimately, it was very rewarding, and I have finished it in time for the premiere of the new season, which is this weekend, on Appreciation Day. so it's sort of perfect in that way. So Breaking Bad was the thing I was going to mention, but I do have something else actually that comes to mind as I sit here in terms of appreciation, and this is also something that has come up for me this week and in recent weeks and months, but I have been making much more use on the blog, as you know, if you read the blog, of some of NPR's interns who have been doing some writing for me. This is not strictly a phenomenon of the last year. I have had a couple before that who did do some terrific writing, and some wonderful writers who I miss and who we value a lot. But more and more, I have come to appreciate the ability of some of our interns to bring really different. In a way, it's a sort of a bittersweet realization of your own aging process.
Yeah.
that you realize that it really does sound a bit different from your own voice when somebody is 25 or younger in many cases. So I really did want to say that I think a lot of the NPR interns, both the ones who work for digital arts and I also know some of the ones who work for music,
absolutely,
have done some marvelous writing. And the only bad thing about it is the more I get to know them and get to know their work, the more sad I am when they leave. But it really is a function of the last year that I've come to make better use of the opportunity for them to have a good experience and for me to have good writing. So so I would also say Breaking Bad and interns.
Go interns.
Right? Pretty good company, guys, right? Stephen Thompson.
Well, I mean, first of all, I'd like to echo what Trey was saying about, you know, the pop culture happy hour audience.
Oh, yes. And I should say, on that topic, I did want to say hi to the guy who told me at Silver Docks, overheard me at the Silver Docks Documentary Festival talking and turned around and said, "Are you Lynn Holmes?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "I listen to you on a podcast." So hi, a guy from Silver Docks.
Yeah. I mean, I just can't say enough about how much I appreciate everybody who listens to the show. And as I've said before, you know, the show is an engine that runs on enthusiasm. And, you know, when people are on our Facebook page, and I mean, well, we got an email recently from someone at the Brooklyn Bridge Animal Welfare Coalition.
Oh,
my God.
Well,
it's awesome for 3 out of 4 of us.
Right. Well, we'll leave that alone. They had named a litter of kittens after the Pop Culture Happy Hour crew.
Yeah.
And now, unfortunately, the only kitten that remains unadopted is Thompson.
Oh, you're burying the lead there, Thompson.
who remains lonely and unloved.
But what happened to Weldon?
No, we don't want to go there. That's too
sad. It's too soon. It's too soon. Apparently, I did exchange emails.
Caught a virus and didn't make it.
Okay, listen.
Stop it.
The world will make more kittens named Weldon. Apparently, they do also have an Ira. Who is an older...
no, really?
Yes, an older cat who also remains unadopted. So, for God's sake, people, everybody loves Ira Glass. Adopt Ira.
Go to Brooklyn. Ira.
Go to the Brooklyn Bridge Animal Welfare Coalition. I've got plenty of cats. Nobody drop any cats off at my doorstep. I got plenty. But please, somebody, won't you adopt little Thompson? I have seen pictures. He's adorable.
They call him Tommy.
They do call him Tommy. He's a little orange cat with a white chin, kind of like my own Clementine.
Aww.
And I am quite fond of Tommy.
Let's get in the car and go get him.
I kind of want to, but I've already got two cats.
Let's go get him.
I don't need more cats. The actual thing that I did not come to appreciate the audience in the last year. I've appreciated the audience all along. So what I've chosen for something that I have come to appreciate in the last year is something that I've noticed while embarking on my sort of year-round mission of putting together year-end mix CDs. Every year, as my friends know, I put together a 2-disc set of all of what I consider the year's best songs. Now, the last 2 years, our friend of the show, Margaret H. Willison, described the last 2 years as, "Now that's what I call divorce, volumes 1 and 2.
Oh, God.
Now...
hadn't heard that one.
Now, I like a sad song. I am a mope. I'm sort of piggybacking on what Trey said. I consider myself a reclusive extrovert. Mm-hmm. I love the people, and I love to hide.
Good.
It's true. Now, I noticed that while putting together throughout the course of the year my best songs of 2012 mix, that it is sort of happy and upbeat song after happy and upbeat song after happy and upbeat song. And the list of artists is, it's just a bunch of wonderful songs. I mean, some of them I've talked about on this show, like Best Coast and Japandroids, also Kishibashi. I know that, that Linda is a huge fan of Kishibashi, a band called Now Now, John K. Samson from The Weakerthans, Cloud Nothings, Not a Surf, Gaslight Anthem, Japandroids, Carly Rae Jepsen, who I've also talked about on the show, Jack White, Fun, Fanfarlo, Spiritualized. Not all of them are purely uplifting. There are dark undertones, but I've been
heartened. Yeah, you realize poor Carly Rae doesn't get the boy, right?
She believes in herself enough to hand him her phone number. So, you know, listening to sort of what I've put together as the first disc, I'm incredibly heartened by sort of an embrace of more upbeat music, and I feel like that is somewhat of a discovery in the last year for me.
Good. Wonderful. Excellent. I hope that all of you will participate in Appreciation Day and also will come to Facebook or come to the blog and tell us what you've come to appreciate this year. Anybody who, you know, you might want to appreciate, who you know doesn't pay any attention to Twitter, you can come and tell us how much you appreciate them, because we love those kind of stories. So come and find us and talk to us about Appreciation Day. And that brings us to our final segment of the show. What is making us happy this week? I'm going to kick over and start with Glenn Weldon. What's making you happy this week?
Very quickly, there's a web comedy sketch that just premiered today called The Dark Knight Plus 60s Robin. it is exactly what you imagine. It's somebody playing Christian Bale's Batman. It's somebody playing Burt Ward's Robin coming together. Hilarity ensues. It's by a sketch comedy group called Paulaloo Mixtape, which is Paul W. Downs and Lucia Agnello. And we'll send a link to it. I don't want to say anything about it. It's great.
Wonderful.
Wow, that sounds great.
Excellent. That's what's making Glenn Weldon happy this week. Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
Glenn was so efficient, and I'm really glad, because I have three. I have one real item, and I have two very brief items, which are really just about getting to say the names of people whose names are delightful to say. So let me do that really quickly. Benedict Cumberbatch is going to have a guest spot on The Simpsons. He will be voicing the British Prime Minister, plus another character who is described as being merely snake-like. Nina Arianda, my other favorite name of the season, just won a Tony Award for Venus in Fur, and has just today, as we tape this, been announced as the star of a Janis Joplin biopic from the guy who directed Martha Marcy May Marlene.
Yeah, sure.
So Nina Arianda and Martha Marcy May Marlene, I can only say go Jackie Jump Jump.
Yes.
But the main thing that I'm really happy about is that the Washington Monument needs $15 million worth of repairs. Now that the now that the damage assessment from last year's earthquake.
Did you not know that Trey was in the Washington Monument repair business on the side?
Anyway, they finished the damage assessment from last year's earthquake, and you will perhaps think that this is an odd thing to be making me happy, but I would reply to you that the repairs will require the whole monument to be wrapped in a scaffolding. And the Park Service has put out a bid for this thing, and they've told the Washington Post this week that they hope to do something like what they did in 1999, when the architect and designer Michael Graves designed a kind of translucent skin for the monument, which was getting a facelift at the time. With any luck, if the money side of this thing works out, we're going to have another really beautiful public art project along the lines of the Michael Graves thing, which was gorgeous and became a sort of tourist attraction in its own right and got written up all over the world. So that's what's making me happy, and I've got my fingers crossed that it's really going to happen.
Wonderful. Stephen Thompson.
Sort of an assortment. First of all, for those of you who live in Washington, D.C., they are opening a Barcade franchise. We've talked on recent episodes about my love of vintage video games, and now there is a bar with that presumably is going to serve beer that will have vintage arcade machines, and so now I'll have a place to go other than my living room to play them. Speaking of vintage video games, I saw the trailer over the weekend for Wreck-It Ralph.
Yeah. I kind of like the look of that.
Yeah, I like the look of that too. I mean, it really looks absolutely like it was made entirely for me. In it a kind of Donkey Kong style or, you know, early 80s video game villain sort of breaks free and decides to be a good guy. And it looks like it's going to have a lot of the kind of visual jokes that you get in that, like that Futurama episode I was talking about with, you know, where it's just full of vintage video game references. So I continue to be a nerd, continue to be excited about those things. And finally, I have kind of a Trey Graham-esque thing that's making me happy.
Hey.
And that is a video that we put up on the NPR music site within the last few days. And Trey knows exactly what I'm talking about, in which Anastasia Tsiolkos, who is on the NPR classical music team, had this idea to assemble a flash choir to form on Times Square in New York, got like what looks like a good 100 people.
I think they said like 220 showed
220 up. People showed up. They were given sheet music of this Philip Glass piece, you know, in honor of his
75th birthday.
In honor of his 75th birthday, they got, you know, a couple hundred people who can sing, mm-hmm. you know, who can read,
and
can read music. Got them together in the middle of Times Square and recorded this piece, and it's just really, really beautiful. The whole thing from start to finish, you know, we've got these great engineers, capture the kind of street noise and mm-hmm. kind of just what it would be like to be there. The whole thing lasts maybe 8 minutes. We'll throw up a link on the blog, but the flash choir in Times Square.
Wonderful. Some of you know, you certainly know if you follow me on Twitter, that I spent quite a few days leading up to the 4th of July without power in my apartment as a result of the derecho. So I have been focused on, with the return of power and the ability to live in my house successfully and replace the stuff that went bad in my refrigerator, etc. I have tried to replace my frustration over not having power with my appreciation of simple life in my own house. The fact that I can get up and make coffee, and the fact that I have air conditioning, and the fact that I can run my many ceiling fans. I have a small apartment and I have 3 ceiling fans. It's one of the best things about the place. So this is not a particular time when I'm focused on giant happy-making things, but on small happy-making things. I can be cool in my own house. I can get a good night's sleep in my own bed. And right now, I'm making it a sort of simple pleasures sort of a period of time. And so that's really what's making me happy, is just those small little things that I find that I'm more grateful for now that I went for a few days having to sort of live like a nomad on various couches. Thank you, Stephen Thompson. Thank you, Stephen Thompson, and my sister, who is also awesome. And that's what's making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon, WELDON. You can follow our esteemed producer, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music. You are tapping your foot to it right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Hell yeah.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you next week.